And I'm out the door, actually. In fact, you can lock the door behind me as I go out. Okay, that's no problem. Uh-huh. We're in business. Okay, is it the 15th today?
16th.
The 16th. It's July 16th. We're in Stockton, California. I'm talking to Jimmy Bigelow, but he's going to do what we all do, which is state your name and your birth date.
Okay, my name's Jimmy K. Bigelow. Uh-huh. April 28th, 1944.
Okay. And where were you born?
I was born in Amarillo, Texas, mm-hmm. in the panhandle of the Texas area, but spent a couple of years there, but didn't live long mm-hmm. in that area. Left pretty much right around when I was 2 years old. Mm-hmm. Dad was in the Air Force, so did a lot of travel mm-hmm. on the road, so I don't have my Texas accident.
You never really got a
lost
chance
it a
to
long time ago.
Something like Ma, and yeah, that was it. Right. Yes, that's right. Because one of the questions we ask, you come from a rural or urban background, but in your military, that's a different category.
Exactly.
It doesn't really fit.
Yeah.
My wife was an Army brat.
Uh-huh.
Where did you go to high school?
Went to high school, was fortunate enough to have 3 years in the same high school, mm-hmm. Just down the road, El Capitan High School in Merced, California.
Mm-hmm. And well, your father was in the Air Force.
He was in the Air Force.
And what was your mother doing? Was she a teacher or a homemaker?
No, she was a homemaker, mm-hmm. and Dad was stationed at Castle Air Force Base in Merced, mm-hmm. and we came from Baltimore, I think it was 1960, so I was able to do 3 years at El Capitan in Merced, mm-hmm. and he actually went to Vietnam, even though he was in the Air Force, he went to Vietnam in 1963, mm-hmm. so he was gone from Merced for a year.
But he was with the Air Force.
He was with the Air Force, but interesting enough, he was sent there as a civilian mm-hmm. on a civilian passport. And later on, I found out he was doing a lot of intelligence work. His field was intelligence. Mm-hmm. So when he went to Vietnam and stayed in Vietnam, he was under the guise of a civilian.
Mm-hmm. What kind of civilian guise did he have?
Well, he had a civilian passport, and uh-huh. he worked in this, quote, civilian office. Uh-huh. In fact, I think he worked in the Rex building in Saigon, the old Rex building there.
Which has such a nice rooftop garden.
Yes, it does. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And didn't tell me much at all. In fact, when he left, I didn't know where it was going until I was actually at the airport. It was kind of a hush-hush thing. Mom mm-hmm. knew where it was going. Of course, I was a high schooler then. We went over to San Francisco and saw him off on a commercial air flight. And as we were walking out the door, and just before I shook hands with him, he said, I'll see you later, son. I'm going to be going to Vietnam for a year. And everything will be okay. And I said, okay, Pop. So he was gone for a year, and he came back, and he never discussed the situation with me until years later. So mm-hmm. he was just doing a lot of work, intelligence work.
So what year did he go?
63 to 64. Mm-hmm. He was gone for a full year.
The whole year?
Yeah, a whole year.
Whole year.
Yeah.
And just a couple of background questions.
Sure.
What religious denomination were you?
Basically, I was raised as a Methodist.
Uh-huh. And when did you first hear about IBS?
Very interestingly enough, approximately maybe about 100 yards out to the west there, mm-hmm. we're sitting on the top of Burns Tower now.
On the campus of University of the Pacific.
Right.
Huh?
And I was president of the on-campus YMCA mm-hmm. in 1966. That's when I was a senior here. And the last month before I graduated, I think, in late May of 66. Around the 1st of May, a gentleman, and I can't remember his name, came to our campus and set up a small information booth at the YMCA right over here. Mm-hmm. And he was very quiet, very gentle type of soul, and I was one of the people who wandered over and sat down and talked with him about what IBS was, what they were doing, where they were doing it. And I was really, really interested in the program. I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I was graduating in just a matter of weeks with a degree in philosophy and a second major in English literature. Mm-hmm. The thing I had facing me at that time was the draft. Mm-hmm. As soon as I graduated, I was going to be draftable. Mm-hmm. And I had the whole question of Vietnam facing me at that time. Mm-hmm. And the IBS experience was sitting there in front of me, and I was, you know, offered the opportunity to come to Washington, D.C., and it just so happens in 1966, my mother and father had left the previous year, and my dad was stationed in Washington, D.C. So I went out there that summer, and this gentleman said that if I wanted to join IBS, that I would meet him at the base of the Washington Monument, I believe it was June the 19th. It was on a Sunday, something like that.
June 19th of 1966.
Yeah, and you'd have to check the calendar to see if that, but I know it was a Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And I went through the whole throes of decision making, and you know, what am I going to do, Vietnam, and I met him there, mm-hmm. and joined IBS, and spent several weeks in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. In the language training and the linguistics training, and took off and went to Vinh Nam, Vietnam, mm-hmm. for a month of language training there. So the situation with my draft board was that I was never given a deferment. Mm-hmm. My draft board was located in Merced. Mm-hmm. It was a very conservative draft board, probably still is. I did write them a letter. I had IBS write them a letter telling them what my intentions were and that I would be serving in Vietnam as an educator. I remained a 1A during the whole time I was in Vietnam, and in fact I got a notice to report for the draft at the end of my first year in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I got communications was somewhat slow over there. I was in Pleiku in the highlands.
in 1966.
And yeah. So I got the mail, which came through basically USAID at that time.
Uh-huh.
And I got a call up to report for my physical. The time had already expired.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mind boggling that I was receiving a call up. And I'm standing in Pleiku, mm-hmm. in the middle of the war in Vietnam, and they want to draft me. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing I did was I went over to a friend of mine who had a USAID office, and I borrowed a typewriter and sat down and typed out a letter, and I said, I'm going to stay my second year in Vietnam, and if you would like to file charges or whatever you do when somebody doesn't show up, you go ahead and do whatever you need to do. And I addressed it to the Merced draft board. They wrote me a letter which came back about 6 weeks, 2 months later, saying that I would be allowed to stay in Vietnam for 1 year only, that I would be given a 1 year deferment, and that at the moment I entered the United States, I would receive my 1A again, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
Within the week back in the States, I did. Mm-hmm. So,
happened then, by the way, just for information?
Then I was called up. I was told that I was going to have to report for physical.
Uh-huh.
And it was that year that I returned, that summer of 1968, when President Johnson said that he would allow deferments for any young person going into academic career graduate school. He would allow the draft boards to give you a 1 year deferment. So when I got back in the States, I had hepatitis, which I actually probably got in Cambodia. I wasn't feeling that great, but I went back, stayed about a month here in California. Went back to Washington, D.C., where my parents were located. Applied to and got into American University, mm-hmm. in Southeast Asia Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, mainly, to avoid that draft situation that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
And academically, I did fine, but I was just having a real problem coping with the whole cultural scene.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any validity to reverse cultural shock, mm-hmm. I'm a living example of it. I couldn't deal with what was happening politically on the American University campus, much less in the United States,
mm-hmm.
having been there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that I was going to try to academically at least prepare myself to go back, perhaps to teach or later on teach.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I spent my first year at American University, did very well. I had a journalism and Southeast Asia major and minor going.
Mm-hmm.
The moment I finished my first year there, Merced draft board knocking again.
Mm-hmm.
Call up for my physical again. They were relentless. They weren't going to let me do anything. Got a car. Found somebody who wanted a car driven to back to California. A buddy and I drove across states to California. And in another quirk, sometimes I think fate, but I go a little further than fate. I probably meant to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was up camping where I live now. And I've always been an avid camper hiker up in the Motherlode area. And river runner.
Mm-hmm.
Came down off the mountain after a couple of nights on the camping. Came down into the little town of San Andreas, and I inquired about teaching jobs anywhere, mm-hmm. in the Motherlode, in that area. And within about 15 minutes I had a teaching job, but more importantly I had a teaching job teaching American Indians,
mm-hmm.
in the little town of Railroad Flat, population 100, mm-hmm. up about 3,000 feet, and I had some Miwok Indians, would have Miwok Indians,
mm-hmm.
and that was the magic word.
Mm-hmm.
Director of the man who hired me wrote a letter to my draft board saying, Mr. Pickle's going to be employed in teaching Native Americans. And that was one of the clauses that would allow you to be deferred. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote a letter to my draft board, and I actually had started my teaching year. It was about 2 months into my teaching year, mm-hmm. waiting for the next letter from the draft board. And mm-hmm. I'll never forget, because I got my mail in McCallum Hill at the time, and came down the hill, and there was the old envelope from the draft board. And mm-hmm. so I cut it open. I said, well, this is it. Either I'm going to probably be drafted, because I'm not going to run away to Canada, or I'm going to be allowed to teach 1 year, 1 year deferment. So, and then I was too old at the end of that year. I was 24. Mm-hmm. Too old to go fight a war, I guess you might say. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the story of how I got into IBS. I went into IBS specifically to come to grips with how I felt about and where my stance was with Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. So you hadn't any objection, a conscientious objection to the war then, because you were uninformed?
No. And in fact, when you mentioned the word, I did, when I got my call-up in the middle of Vietnam, my first year, I did apply for a CO, conscientious objection, standing there, but it was rejected. And so I always maintained my 1A status there for many, many years on throughout. And I came to grips with it. I'm glad I made that choice. It was a good experience for me personally, and kind of made me who I am. Yeah, it's a good experience.
Well, let's see how it made you who
sure.
you were.
Go ahead.
So you just happened to be at the YMCA.
Yeah, and I was a student here, and uh-huh. I spent a lot of time over there. Mm-hmm. So, and I was the president there. And
did you feel that you had absorbed either from your parents or from the Methodist Church a sense of public service or a desire to serve?
Probably not so much from the church. Mm-hmm. Mom and Dad were both helpers in their business. Dad being in the Air Force, he was in several helping organizations. He was helped with the Boy Scouts, I remember specifically, when we were stationed in Baltimore, Maryland. In fact, I was a Boy Scout and eventually became an Eagle Scout. Mom always had her fingers in community service and enjoyed doing a lot of different things. She was a great advocate of playing bridge and doing community activities around the base mm-hmm. or whatever. So I think there was probably a sense, and there still is a sense, at least in my being, of one of my qualities, I think, is helping. I've always had a strong sense of helping people.
Yeah, I know. I know that feeling because my parents are similar. And but it's hard to imagine with people so hard-pressed these days economically for them to have that same kind of, Depression-era kid outlook mm-hmm. or Depression-era outlook where you had a sense of obligation mm-hmm. to others. It doesn't seem now that it's easy for mm-hmm. young people to absorb that from mm-hmm. their
yeah.
parents.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. So you went, since it was June of 66 where you showed up at the Washington Monument,
right.
which, of course, now you can turn and look down at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Exactly right.
And you went, was Harper's Ferry active then?
Yes, went up there for kind of an orientation, I think it was, about a week, 5-6 days, something, 3 or 4 days, something like that.
Do you remember any people who were there when you were there?
Well, let's see. I had a close buddy named John Pope, but he, as far as an IVS or I know where he is. He's in the military, and he's a naval chaplain. I believe right now he's stationed at 29 Palms. In Southern
California. Oh, wait, hey, now that's wonderful. Uh-huh. His name is what?
Pope, P-O-P-E.
Uh-huh, and his first name?
John.
Oh, okay.
And you'd have to give me a call tonight to get his address.
Okay.
But I know he's been there probably 2 years out of a 3 to 4 year commitment now.
Okay.
Maybe 3 years. Maybe he's on his
3 years. He would be very easy to, I mean, that's a very easy person
is
to track
it?
Down.
Okay.
This 29 Palms is essentially uh-huh. just a very long car ride
yeah.
from my house,
yeah. uh-huh.
my parents' house in L.A.
He and I went through our language training in Vinh Long together. And of course, there were about 14 people. I can kind of think of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
I can remember the 14 people standing out by the old DC-3. I think we stood down, we flew down there and on DC-3. But John was one of my close friends, and quite frankly, in the 2 years that I was in Pleiku, I rarely saw another IVS, except I went to Saigon a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I flew over to Thuy Hoa, which is on the coast,
mm-hmm.
South China Sea coast of Vietnam, and my friend John was stationed there.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a couple times when I hitchhiked a plane ride over there, maybe 2 or 3 times a year,
mm-hmm.
and spent maybe a week with him, just sunning in the sun and enjoying the ocean and and doing things like that. So.
Well, just for the fun of it, whenever you mention a Vietnamese town name, mm-hmm. for the poor student that's transcribing this, if you could spell it.
Okay.
So like Thuy Hoa.
Thuy Hoa is T-U-Y-H-O-A. Mm-hmm. This Thuy Hoa, two words.
And Pleiku, P-L-E-I-K-U.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And this is interesting because I just finished, I was interviewing John Scarborough yesterday, mm-hmm. and he worked amongst the Cham. He never saw anybody, he didn't care to see anybody, mm-hmm. but he spent 2 years essentially on his own mm-hmm. without hardly any connection with IVS.
Yes.
And so I had all these questions which immediately became irrelevant, but I had to go through anyway.
I understand.
But he ended up in Ban Mi Thuot, and of course he was captured mm-hmm. in 75. Yes, uh-huh. He was working for, was he on a Fulbright then? Or, but he wasn't with IVS then.
Yeah.
And did that. And did you ever go to the Dalat Christmas party?
Never went there. Never
did. You stayed at Pleiku for 2 years?
Pretty much.
More or less.
Yeah,
well, this is going to be fascinating
as we
probe this.
I had a really close group of Vietnamese people. Mm-hmm. Close meaning close in the sense of friends. Mm-hmm. Just really friends. And from the moment that I got there, I was totally very isolated, completely on my own. Mm-hmm. But became friends with mainly the teaching staff and the little school.
Well, let's, before we get into
sure,
that, because we are, that is the uh-huh. focus of okay. what we're going to be talking about. You arrived, what was your first impression when you arrived in Saigon?
Oh, first impressions. Having been in the Air Force, or having been from an Air Force family, having lived in Izmir, Turkey for 2 years, having traveled somewhat in Europe, I wasn't struck so much by the foreignness. This was my first experience with an Asian culture. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't struck so much about the foreignness. I guess I was struck by the vitality, particularly the friendliness of the people, the hustle and bustle of Saigon, particularly. But a sense of enjoying being there, feeling that this was a really good, right decision that I make, had made to come with IVS and to come to Saigon and to come to Vietnam. So it was... There was a hustle and bustle, there was a lot of color, there was a lot of emotion. I was struck that there was so much vitality in a city, in a country at war. Mm-hmm. I really had no first impressions of a country at war or fighting or killing or death, things like that. Mm-hmm. It was mainly an impression of life.
Thompson, you just looked like an average airbase
yeah.
in 1960s.
Not average.
No, not average.
In fact, I remember snapping a picture out of one time I was in Tanzania. You know, you have there. Your fighter aircraft waiting in line with the commercial aircraft to take off or something like that, and your numerous helicopters. And so, no, it's not your average. Just every type of aircraft that you can imagine, fighter and commercial, all out there. In the
By 66, did they have those huge concrete revetments?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh, yes, they did.
They're still there, of course.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Those last forever, they don't go away. Now they're covering Soviet helicopters, mm-hmm. so it's one thing or the other. And you went? Did you go to the IBS house from the airport?
Went to the IBS house.
Did you have seven ways of beef? The seven.
Offhand, I can't remember. I can't remember what we ate there, but I'm sure it was probably Vietnamese food.
Mm-hmm.
But
Don took everybody out.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, we may have. I wrote journals. I kept a journal while I was mm-hmm. there, and I would have to reread. Perhaps I made an inscription about that. But I remember that I enjoyed being at the IBS house, and I enjoyed being with these people. And I liked Don as a man from when I first met him, and it seemed like there was an excitement in the air. I was excited about being there, mm-hmm. and I don't think we were at IVS House too long, maybe 2 or 3 days, and then we went down. Our group went
right.
down to Vinh Long, which
right.
is south of there. It's V-I-N-H, Long, L-O-N-G, I believe,
mm-hmm.
uh-huh. and we spent a month down there, at a little place, and we the 14 people. Worked with two Vietnamese teachers, one male and one female, and had some good instruction. We're able to go out into the little community and order foods and eat off the local market and get those little Siklo rides and things like that.
Were you ever given any teaching English as a foreign language instruction?
We got in Washington, D.C., we got a linguistics, week-long linguistics class. Now, I didn't find the linguistics to be of help to me in teaching English as a second language. Academically, it focused things in my academic mind,
mm-hmm.
but I never found that I used the linguistic study in my teaching English as a foreign language in Vietnam in the classroom. So it was mainly that basis, but we had some books we could choose to teach, which were basically donated by USAID. English for Today, I believe it was.
English for Today.
Yeah, right.
And when did you find, you were with a group of instructors who were designated to teach, to be educationists, I think was the term.
Yeah.
And you went to Vinh Long, and from there you went where?
From there, actually we received our assignments in Vinh Long. Mm-hmm. There was some choice. I had been kind of studying the terrain of Vietnam, at least map-wise, and looking at the stations that were available, et cetera. And an IBSer could make a choice. They could say, I'd really like to go to a section. I'd like to go to the coast, highlands, et cetera. And I really had I'd done a little reading, and I had a fondness probably for the highlands, probably because of the highlands in here in California, mm-hmm. the gold country. Mm-hmm. And interesting enough, Pleiku was just a touch over the same elevation I'm living at now. I think Pleiku was around 2,600 feet. Mm-hmm. I liked the cooler weather, mm-hmm. and they did have nice, cool, sometimes cold weather up there during the certain part of the seasons. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to go to the highlands was my first choice, and I was fortunate to get a Pleiku choice. Well, there was Kontum, mm-hmm. Pleiku, and several of the villages in the highlands, but I was very pleased with going to Pleiku.
I'm just having trouble conceiving that it's like Doc Toe, which would be an IBS from Doc Toe. So how can they, come on! I'm enjoying this, this feeling.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I received the assignment like about maybe the week before we left, and then that was just about, once we left Vinh Long, we went back to Saigon for a brief day or two, and then the 14 of us dispersed. Mm-hmm. And of those 14, I bet I never saw, except for John Pope, my buddy, I hardly ever saw him ever again. Occasionally I would run into maybe not the IBS house if I was down there in Saigon, but I bet I didn't go down there maybe once or twice a year. Probably didn't go down there more than four times in my 2 years I was there. Mm-hmm. I went through there mainly at the end of my first year. Each IBSer was given a month off, about 3 weeks to 4 weeks off. Mm-hmm. And I took advantage of that, and I went to Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. I toured a lot of Southeast Asia, hitchhiked throughout Southeast Asia.
Did you go to Angkor Wat?
Got over to Angkor Wat on my way back, got down Malaya, and actually got over to Sarawak and Brunei and Jesselton. Got up to Mount Kinabalu, the highest mountain in Southeast Asia. Down to Indonesia, was down there quite often, went down there, and then to some of the standard places like Hong Kong and Thailand and Cambodia. I went into Cambodia when I left IBS on my way home. I went in and spent about 10 days in Cambodia. Enjoyed it very much.
That's a very different atmosphere.
Yeah, I never made it to Laos. I never, as close as I was at all those years, I never made it to Laos.
So you went up to Pleiku, mm-hmm. and what was it like when you arrived in Pleiku? What was your impression?
The man who took me up was named Gene, but I can't remember his last name.
Stolfus.
Stolfus, that's it. Thank you very much.
I have all your memories now.
Okay.
I mean, I've been after 30 for 30 people. I might, yes, go ahead.
He and I flew up on a commercial, not a commercial, but a military aircraft, probably a C-131. Mm-hmm. We landed late in the evening, mm-hmm. and he had a command of the language. Mm-hmm. And I didn't. I certainly was nowhere fluent in the language. And it was almost a comedy of errors. First of all, just getting from the airbase into the Pleiku area, which is about 5-6 miles, and then locating the school, and then locating anybody in charge. By the time we had located the head of the school, the principal, so to speak, it was well into the evening. It was probably getting close to midnight. Mm-hmm. And talk about a memory, a visual image. Sitting by candlelight with this gentleman and with Gene, over at the school around midnight, and this gentleman had no idea that I was coming to teach at his school, none whatsoever. Uh-huh. And Gene was sitting there talking with him in Vietnamese, and you know, I was picking up just bits and pieces here and there, and he's saying to me, he said, look like they don't, they didn't know you were coming to teach here. Mm-hmm. This guy had no idea that I was coming to teach there. And they're resolving the issue, that no problem, yeah, okay, that's fine. And then, where do I live? Oh, well, nothing had been, no groundwork had been done there. I think Jean had thought that some work had been done by USAID, but something got tied up. Eventually, I ended up in just a little tiny room. You would liken it perhaps to a concrete shed. Mm-hmm. And it had a bunk bed in it and a mosquito screen. And that was about it. And then I had an outside toilet, which was very common at that time. Mm-hmm. Had a rain barrel that caught rain, which was catching rain at that time. See, in that time of the year, yes, it was getting some rain at that time. And that was my wash water.
That must have been you. You must have been there around July?
Yeah. I got there in July, right? Probably at the end of July. Maybe around the 1st of August, mm-hmm. sometime around there. And just caution, I was given some sea rations. I scrambled some sea rations and some sternal burn, caution to boil the water, and that was it. Jean shook my hand, took off. And here I was in this little concrete room by myself, totally. And the few books that I brought, the few possessions, I packed very lightly. And I was also sitting there by candlelight well after midnight, and Jean took off, and that was it. And the next day, I just got up, nice and light, walked out. It was about 3 blocks from the school. Mm-hmm. And I walked over and started talking to the man. And school was not in session. I don't think school started
until summer, in November.
Yeah, sometime later. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the exact time. I eventually got to know the principal, and he was only there a short time. He had to, eventually was taken out of there and had to go into the military. So I never got to know him. He was only about 2 or 3 months, and then another man was appointed principal at the school. And within the first two or three weeks that I was there, I had met probably most of the teachers. I'd met them mainly because the man showed me, the principal, I can't remember his name. Mm-hmm. Introduced me to most of the faculty, and they lived in different parts of Pleiku. Mm-hmm. Pleiku basically was called a hamlet. You could liken it to a small town at that time. There were a fair number of people there, but I was on the outskirts of Pleiku, more in a rural area than, certainly wasn't in a downtown area, but mm-hmm. I was on the outskirts of it. And if it hadn't been for those initial friendship contacts, I probably would not have had the great experience that I did with IBS or in Vietnam period. Mm-hmm. But I guess you might say I was taken under their wings. And let me briefly, mm-hmm. so you can have a visual image, mm-hmm. I want to just show you some of those friends who literally from the beginning.
Oh, you have some pictures.
I had just a couple pictures
okay.
here. I mean, I have a bunch, but I just want to show you so you can, when I talk about certain people, you'll know. Mm-hmm. This is Mr. Dam, mm-hmm. and that's D-A-M, and he is still in Vietnam. And this is Mr. Nguyen, this is Mr. Trung, this is Mr. Yup, and this is Mr. Tan. And Tan is in America now. In fact, he lives in Oroville, mm-hmm. and he was one of the teachers at the school. Mr. Trung eventually became the principal of the school right after that other gentleman left. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Yup is a Montagnard. This is actually taken on Christmas morning, probably of 1967. At his village in Kontum. We were at mm-hmm. his village, and we went up there, and we had water coming down this bamboo pipe. These were the people who initially took me into their wing and treated me as if I were of their culture, mm-hmm. and taught me much of their language and the cult and everything. This is just a newspaper clipping, mm-hmm. and this is Mr. Dom here. Mm-hmm. So these people were very instrumental. One of my, I taught multi-year kids, too, while I was down there. Mm-hmm. This was taken from Mr. Yip's village. Mm-hmm. But if it hadn't been for those initial friendships.
Can I look at this?
Sure. Uh-huh. In fact, if you like it, I'll take you through it very quickly.
Okay, here, let's just shut this off for a second.
Right.
So you arrived in beginning of August of 1967.
Uh-huh. And 66.
You weren't expected. Mm-hmm. You maybe because you weren't expected and because you were just suddenly there and school was out, you were able to make friendships and contacts that maybe had you arrived on schedule, well prepared, mm-hmm. it wouldn't have been as easy to make.
That's possible, yeah. Not exactly right.
And so you had a couple of months there before school started, so what did you do?
One of the first things, the most important, was making the contacts mm-hmm. with the Vietnamese, and as I said earlier in the interview, having established some very close friendships mm-hmm. initially. Once those friendships were established, I don't think I ever had another want or need play coup, because mm-hmm. anytime I needed to know something or needed something, I could just ask my friends. Mm-hmm. They are the ones who show me how to live on the local economy. Mm-hmm. They're the ones who showed me how to eat on the local economy, the places. They're the ones who showed me how to be safe mm-hmm. in the environment of war. They're the ones who taught me how to teach their students, who taught me the customs of education in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I have to thank them because they are also the ones who kept me safe when I thought it was a bad situation at best. And they're the ones who made me happy. They gave me my space. Sometimes I needed to be by myself, and sometimes I just left. I kind of retired. And one time I left and got my own a living space because it was, I felt sometimes cooped up with all the bodies and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess essentially everything I knew and learned about Vietnam were basically came from this small, close-knit community of educators. Mm-hmm. And they were dedicated people. They were really dedicated to teaching the students that they had under the adverse conditions mm-hmm. that were there. And so it was a learning situation from the moment go, learning about the culture and being with them and establishing the friendships and enjoying the good humor and the laughter and the sadness all the time. So mm-hmm. we eventually, we had a funny Vietnamese phrase. It was translated the five devils. It was a group of five guys and myself. We were just close-knit, you know, like a fraternity or brotherhood here in America. We were just Okay. As I started to say, visitations, we did a lot of visiting of people, and quite often it was the home of the parents of the students that we taught. Mm-hmm. I was always amazed how close the Vietnamese teachers were to their students. Mm-hmm. In the classroom, there was a definite separation between the master, the teacher, and the responsibilities of the students, very strict separation. Mm-hmm. In the community, the teachers would socialize with some of the parents and with some of the students. And the students were extremely respectful of the teacher. And I can honestly say, as a teacher, an American teacher, white teacher, a foreign teacher, however you want to classify me, I was equal to the Vietnamese in the respect that was given to them and to me. Mm-hmm. And always felt like I was respected, highly respected as a teacher, first place. And then out of the classroom as a friend, mm-hmm. just a friend of students. I would suspect probably that I learned more about how to teach students and be with kids in those 2 years in Vietnam than I did in any education class in America. Mm-hmm. And that probably set the foundation for my teaching career in the United States, and most of that time has been in California, mm-hmm. was how to be with students, how to be with the students' parents, how to treat students, how to not only enhance the cognitive domain, so to speak, mm-hmm. but how to use the affective domain mm-hmm. Of being with kids. And when I say with kids, I was with young kids over there, but I was also with older students in their teens. So those 2 years in education really laid the foundation of making me what I believe is a successful teacher in the United mm-hmm. States. But I got that from the adults, the people that were there who helped me, the friendships, and how they integrated me and my emotions and my psychic and my intellect into that community. Mm-hmm. And so it was valuable. So thank goodness for that first 6 weeks, 2 months, and then school started. Mm-hmm. I never had a problem in the classroom. Mm-hmm. It was just a wonderful experience. I had as many as 70 kids in some mm-hmm. classrooms. Just a wonderful experience.
How many hours did you teach a day?
We had, and I'm trying to remember the hours, generally speaking, we started, seems to me like it was early, around 7:30. Mm-hmm. We usually go to about 11:30, and there was the siesta time. We would usually take about 2 hours, which included not only eating, but also napping. Mm-hmm. I'm not much of a napper, still not to this day. But that was important to them because it kind of gave you a vitality, a renewal vitality to your body, and I accepted that. That was fine. Later on, because of, you know, the situation, it might be a different season or something like that. Perhaps it was better to go later. But we usually would teach at 7:30 to about 11:30, take a two-hour break, come back and teach to about 4 or 4:30. And then we would teach Saturday mornings also mm-hmm. Throughout the year. I always found it amusing because sometimes I would prepare to go to school and there was no school. Mm-hmm. And I'd be on my way. And then one of my students or one of my male teaching companions, oh, no school today. And I was always, I never got the holidays down. Mm-hmm. You know, there were certain holidays for so-and-so, general so-and-so, or historical holidays mainly. And sometimes I'd be on my way and it'd be a holiday. Mm-hmm. But that was always fun. So there were some days that we had off, similar to teaching. The summers, actually, I can't remember. It seemed to me that we had a two-month summer. I don't know if we had a three-month summer or not. I just can't remember, to tell you the truth. So the teaching days, even the Saturday mornings, I didn't mind going over and teaching on Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. That's
fine. And did, let's see, you were teaching at an elementary school?
It was basically an elementary school. The grade equivalents probably would be, it's called Drumha Play Ku. Essentially, it means the school of Play Ku. And the grade level equivalencies were probably from about 6 to about 12. Kind of like an enhanced middle school, perhaps you might say. And those grade levels, and those age levels, 6 to 12.
Did you have much attrition of the teachers because of being drafted?
Not much. Mm-hmm. Right after the Tet Offensive, two of the teachers were drafted, mm-hmm. but they were allowed to come back. And when they taught, they taught in their military uniforms. Mm-hmm. They didn't teach in civilian uniforms. Our staff pretty much remained at the staff at the end of those 2 years that it was at the beginning of my mm-hmm. 2 years at that time.
And did you get APO in Play Ku, or how did you get your MAE?
It must, I'm sure it came from the military. Mm-hmm. My contacts with the military were very minor. The air base was about 4 or 5 miles away. There was a large military, army military establishment south of Play Ku. I saw military personnel in and around Play Ku, mm-hmm. Probably every other day. And I'm trying to think, how did I get my mail? I know there was a MACV compound there, and perhaps I went over and got mail occasionally. It seems to me it was mailed to MACV or USAID. Mm-hmm. There was a USAID compound somewhere in Play Ku. And I think I went down there once a week to check on mail. I believe it came to that. Probably an APO number. Is that Army Post Office? Mm-hmm. Something like that, right?
You mentioned that you didn't so much develop a relationship, but you certainly got to know a sergeant at the air
yeah,
base.
Uh-huh.
How did that come about?
Well, I can't specifically remember when I met him. Mm-hmm. I also sometimes, after I'd been there for a while, I realized that war or the military is a fertile ground for acquiring things, and not surreptitiously, but legitimately, because there's so much stuff, mm-hmm. and the Vietnamese had so little. At least my Vietnamese friends had so little, and sometimes I would I'd go out to the air base, and I had PX privileges or commissary privileges. I had a card, and it identified me. It was one of those cards, and I could buy some food goods. I was a non-drinker when I went to Vietnam, and I learned how to drink in Vietnam, and not necessarily that that's something that's be proud of, but I would sometimes buy beer or whiskey or cigarettes for the Vietnamese and share them with them. And I never became a smoker, though occasionally I did smoke, but sometimes we would have a party, and I would bring my part in and give them some maybe some foodstuffs that were unique to Vietnam or something like that. I probably met Sergeant Burroughs out there. I was very fond of aircraft. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, when I went out there, I usually went out to the airstrip and would just look at and talk to people about aircraft. Mm-hmm. And I probably met him. He was on a fire rescue team, and it was he was in charge of a helicopter that had a very interesting top prop. The props intertwined. Mm-hmm. There were two top props, mm-hmm. and I was out there once for a demonstration. It seems to me it was a rescue helicopter where they were able to put out aircraft fires mm-hmm. by using a large bucket of some kind of a fire retardant that they mm-hmm. would drop. And I'm sure that that's how I met him there. Mm-hmm. And I specifically asked him one time, I said, you know, I have a teacher in town, and this is always mind-boggling. I'm going to digress for a minute. When I did meet the military, when I did run into military, I was always a civilian.
They always assumed you were CIA.
Yeah. They would assume I was something that was like CIA or who the hell are you? Uh-huh. I remember one of the classic situations was I was walking with Mr. Dom in the little town of Pleiku, the hamlet. We were downtown, so to speak, mm-hmm. Where they had the market and things like that. And I was walking with him, and there were some GIs on the street. And we were walking towards these two Vietnamese students, girls, who were students of ours. And when the girls approached us, and this is very standard, about 10 feet from us, they took their hats off and they bowed. Mm-hmm. And these two GIs were standing here. They go, they see these two girls bow to us like this. And then they moved on. And this one, the GI, who in the hell are you? You know, I was in a civilian, I was with the V. Who the hell are you? I said, well, I'm a teacher here. I go, teacher? He could not comprehend that I, here was an individual teaching in Vietnam in the town in which he was, you know, part of the military role. And it just, he was almost beyond him teaching. Mm-hmm. Well, how come they bowed at you? Well, it's a sign of respect, you know. Teachers are esteemed in Asia, mm-hmm. particularly in Vietnam, you know. And so that was kind of a funny incident.
Did
anyway.
You say anything else?
No.
Because there's some hilarious, I mean, I suddenly realized that a while back that grunts would have a really strange view of seeing going into a combat zone, uh-huh. you know, and seeing these barefoot guys without guns, and they used to shout it at IBS. It was like, what the hell are you doing here? And
yes, exactly.
Where's your gun? And how long are you here for? Uh-huh. And when they realized you were there for 2 years, it was beyond their understanding.
Well, there was another incident along the similar lines. I told you that my friend John Pope, and he lived in Tweewa. Mm-hmm. And he had USAID gave him a scooter, and I had access to a scooter sometimes. But we were out in Tweewa, we'd been swimming, and we got on his scooter, and we had a pair of bathing shorts on, and we had kind of a flowery shirt on, and I was on the back, and he was driving, and he said, I want to show you some really pretty country. So we drove inland from Tweewa on a dirt road and took off north. Mm-hmm. And we had checked with some of his Vietnamese friends, you know, see if it was safe and everything. And we drove out probably about 4 or 5 miles on the scooter, and we're just puttering down this dirt road. Mm-hmm. And we run into a company of American soldiers coming towards us. Mm-hmm. And the guy, he just put his hand, he said, stop for a second. He said, what in the hell do you think you guys are doing? And you know, I'm sure that he probably would have been in battle. Everybody's under stress.
Tremendous
and to
stress.
See these two Americans come ride along on a scooter in a couple tropical shirts, mm-hmm. like, you know, la-di-da. Mm-hmm. There's a war going on, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we're teachers. And he just said, do you know what we're doing here? I said, well, yes, I guess. What do you mean by your question? We just got out of a firefight about 2 miles up the road. What do you think you're doing out here? And I was like, sorry, sir, you know. And he said, I can't believe you guys are out here doing this, whether you're teachers or not. I don't care what the hell you're doing. Get the hell out of here. And we turned around and we went back, you know. But, you know, it's like hitting dead on with something that you just can't comprehend. Mm-hmm. And so, generally speaking, my contact with the military in Vietnam was good. I didn't have much contact, but the contact that I had, like Sergeant Burroughs, mm-hmm. I asked him specifically, I told him, he asked me, do you have needs? And I said, yeah, we have some needs. We need some money to clean our school up. We could use some glass. I don't know if you have any to glass panes or anything like that. Mr. Burroughs, through donations at the air base, raised as many, many thousands of dong, mm-hmm. piastres. And I remember a hilarious trip. Couldn't get glass anywhere. You had to go to the coast. Mm-hmm. And USAID loaned us a scout. And
that's an
international harvester scout, and the Vietnamese somehow got another truck. I don't know where the hell they got it. Mr. Burroughs got us the money to buy the glass, and we had glass panes in these shutter windows. Mm-hmm. And when I arrived, almost all of them were broke. Mm-hmm. And we drove with an American convoy from Pleiku and to the coast, and it wasn't Tweewa, and I can't remember the name of the town. We had the glass cut. And we padded it all up and brought it back, and with the money that Mr. Burroughs had helped, and which mm-hmm. You know, the airmen had donated at the airbase, mm-hmm. and put it in and had it all installed. Well, the irony of it was that was we had it all installed and cleaned up, and that was 1 week before Tet. Mm-hmm. And after Tet, there was none of that glass left. But later on, Mr. Burroughs also was able to get some money to help fix our school up,
paint the damage and paint it.
Mm-hmm. And the flagpole and things like that, and get some more glass. Mm-hmm. And this time we just put in one roll of glass, and we had a Vietnamese carpenter cut wooden panes, mm-hmm. for another roll going all the way across. So my contact was minimal, but generally favorable. And I wasn't hassled. I was, I think, probably the most, the military, their response to me was just kind of a shaking of the head or astounding that, you know, I'm an American civilian living on the Vietnamese culture, and that my part was teaching. And I quite often I get asked about my, you know, my preferences. You know, are you a CO? And there were quite a few demeaning statements about being a CO. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm not a CO. I would like to be, I guess. The draft board won't give it to me. But no, but actually, I just got drafted, and I'm still here. So, and I never lived on the military economy, with the exception that sometimes I would buy the things in the PX. Mm-hmm. And some muscles always shared that. I was thinking about my money. IBS gave me $80 in piastres per month, I believe it was the going rate, $80 in piastres. And then they would send an equivalent amount to my home bank. So I would have a little bit of a nest egg when I got out of Vietnam. I think it was standard procedure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think a month went by when I just didn't give my $80 worth of piastres to my school, to the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had virtually no expenses there because of the way I was treated. Mm-hmm. I mean, I could hardly ever walk in if we were going to go down for pho at midnight some night or breakfast the next morning. I could hardly ever pay for it. They just wouldn't let me. My Vietnamese friends, they'd, we got covered. Or walk into a family's house, something like that, or a store of a family that I knew. I never paid for anything. Mm-hmm. I just gave the Vietnamese my monthly salary.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I never had a monetary need while I was there. And then occasionally I would buy things and give it to them.
Mm-hmm. How was the relationship between Montagnard and Vietnamese students in your school?
In our school, it was very good. Mm-hmm. And I know that traditionally it's almost a racial issue.
Mm-hmm.
In Vietnam, it was probably a racial issue, somewhat similar to our white-black problem or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
We had I have to think that it was a unique school. We had Montagnards, a lot of Montagnards, who came in and lived in a boarding school not too far from our school.
Mm-hmm.
And they came in, and they lived, and they went to school there. Now, about the only evidence that I saw of a bias was that the Montagnards had a Montagnard class. I had a Montagnard class, mm-hmm. but I didn't have a mixed Vietnamese and Montagnard class. Now, occasionally, a Montagnard would come in with a Vietnamese class, but 99% of the time, if I was teaching a Montagnards, I was teaching a Montagnard class, all Montagnards,
mm-hmm.
and Vietnamese, all Vietnamese. I never saw in the classroom, from adults or from students, any animosities towards each other because of race.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Montagnard teacher, Mr. Yeo,
mm-hmm.
was a Montagnard teacher at the school, very highly respected, educated man, could speak many dialects of Montagnard, French and Japanese,
mm-hmm.
and English, very, very well. In fact, almost all the teachers at that school could teach, I think all of them could speak French. We had some female teachers there, but I think we had a staff of about 10.
Mm-hmm.
Almost every one of them could speak French, their own language, obviously,
mm-hmm.
And English. Probably half the staff could speak English very well.
Mm-hmm.
The other half could speak it well to moderate.
Mm-hmm.
And then this multi-year, I knew how to speak Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
It was amazing. Highly respected. Often went to his village in Kantum. We sometimes made specific trips to go to his village. We, the teachers and I, we got some scooters, and
mm-hmm.
it was safe to go. It was, I don't know, 30 clicks up to Kantum from Pleiku. We went to his village a couple times during the year to live, to be in his village. And he had the traditional, his father was the chief of this village, and their house was on stilts, and we went in and drank rice wine and had meat dishes and rice, and stayed there overnight. I spent one Christmas there at his village. So the relations in this case, in this
mm-hmm.
probably specific case, they were good.
Mm-hmm.
They were good with each other. Right here?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Yeob gave me a brass bracelet.
Mm-hmm.
And I wore it for years and years and years. These
mm-hmm.
are not part of,
mm-hmm.
these are not from Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And I wore that bracelet for years and years and years, probably up to about 2 or 3 years ago. And then on a camping trip, it slipped off or
mm.
came off, something like that, and I lost it. And I always felt regretful about that, because it was during that Christmas morning when I was and a couple of us were at his village. And we woke up Christmas morning, and we went out to take a shower. Mm-hmm. That picture of us where the water's coming down the bamboo, we got washed off and everything. We went back into the house and had some rice that morning. And about mid-morning, we started drinking rice wine. And he said something to a young multi-yard girl. Mm-hmm. And she came out, kind of from the shadows, never forget it, you know, came out of the shadows. Kind of reached over my back and slipped that on my arm. And he said, because we are friends. Mm-hmm. And so that was a very special moment. So the moment's there, the bracelet's not.
Mm. Well, the bracelet's just evidence
exactly.
of the moment.
Just a, you know, one of those simple brass bracelets. You've probably seen many of them. That was good. So in answer to your question, I saw more than a coexistence. I saw a genuine friendship and unity and acceptance of the multi-yard Vietnamese culture at my school, in my own little tiny segment of my that little world there. I saw, and having Mr. Yip as one of our teachers said, you know, it made a, it was a very special.
Y-U-P?
Pardon?
How do you spell?
H-I-U-P-P.
H-I-U-P-P. Yes, never play Scrabble with a mountain.
Right. I can still remember one phrase he taught me in his dialect, Khao Krang Ma Nyum Pai, which means we must drink white rice wine.
Yes, that's amazing. I know a friend of mine, Alan Farrell, who's a poet, was a kind of special forces officer. He was always trying to get his Nung mercenaries not to kill all the people that they were trying to just capture to interrogate. And he has a poem about finding a poem in a dead VC's pocket. And that's a very beautiful poem. Yeah. And then another one, though, is S-R-A-P, 1-1-1-3, that's 8, Krumnaplot. Let's see, S-H-N-20-15-45, Mark, M-A-R-K, that's 3-1. That's 16. Uh-huh. Not Lachman.
Uh-huh. Interesting.
And these are just lines of the poem.
Uh-huh.
And then at the end, okay, let's see. That's 25, 45, 50, 275, and 880. No, 880. Never play Scrabble with a Montagnard. Because they're all consonants. You know, they're all these consonants. And of course, when you don't know what the poem's about, you know, it's hard to realize they're Scrabble scores.
Uh-huh.
And then comes the totaling. And then you realize what's been going on. He says, never play Scrabble with a Montagnard.
That's right.
And he's associate dean of the Citadel now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Just thinking of Montagnard experience, you spent some time at his village.
Yes.
And you became friends. Mm-hmm. And how did you feel about, I guess this is a general question we ask everybody, there are kind of two questions. First, did you feel you were providing assistance to the Vietnamese that they could use that would, in the long run or short run, help them or hurt them? Or did your views about that change over time? Did they change your attitude about Montagnards and their involvement in the war? Did that ever enter into what you were thinking? Those are a lot of big questions because I don't want any particular answer. Just
Well, see, I was hired to teach Vietnamese, or anybody who's there, I assume. English is a second language.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, almost from the beginning, especially after I started teaching, I found that that was almost a secondary happening in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I was teaching some of the kids in the multi-yards in the Vietnamese to speak English as a second language, and I was teaching them vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
I was certainly honored for that by those students and those teachers. I felt a high level of frustration, I think, as anybody would in the situation, always thinking the question, well, what's it all about, Alfie?
Mm-hmm.
Or am I making any impressions or inroads? But I would ask that occasionally, and I think I stopped asking that probably after the first 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Because in my opinion, I found that probably what was going on there in Pleiku, what was happening with Jim Bigelow, and what was taking place amongst the people that Jim Bigelow taught or associated with, was something a little more important. Possibly much more important. And it's kind of hard to put in words. The emotional ties that were taking place, the awareness of two individual cultures, I think in particular, became a predominant thing that was taught. And it was not like we sat down and we went to class, but it was like we were just together in our groups, whether we were drinking a bami ba, whether we were singing songs, whether we were out walking, whether we were in Khantoum and Mr. Yip's house, in the classroom, in the parents' houses, eating pho early in the morning, being quiet, laughing, crying. That, in my opinion, there was a real exchange of the genuineness of each culture. And I would suspect that today, you know, like you can probably get a sense, and I can show you pictures, but I am still moved. And you pardon me for a second. I gotta wait to do what I have to do. I am still moved by that experience. You know, I haven't talked about Vietnam in a long time. I know that when I received the few communications from Vietnam, and when I talked to Mr. Tan up in Oroville, that there was an exchange that was made there that went beyond the what I was hired to do. And if that type of exchange could always be done whenever anybody went into the classroom or when any culture went into any culture, then we would probably have a lot less problems, fewer problems than we do. So I feel elevated by those people that touched my lives there. So as far as to the specific purpose, I did my job well, and but I think I went above and beyond the job without sometimes knowing it. And the people with whom I worked and the people towards that I directed my efforts towards, I think that we learned something that was immeasurable about each other's culture.
Do you think that was actually the ultimate IVS experience? That is rather, I mean, obviously there were projects, but what was IVS actually doing? Was that what IVS actually intended to do, do you think? Or that experience was intended to do in a ethos or something?
Yes, I think that was probably the ultimate IVS experience. I would suspect that that probably happened in most cases with the IVSers contact with the Vietnamese and multi-cultures. It's not unique to Jim Bigelow. My situation was unique to me, but the overall picture, I think that, yes, that was the ultimate. It certainly wasn't in the job contract or the job description or the contract that we signed or whatever. We certainly weren't there for money or, you know, or glory or anything like that. And many of us exhibited courage in many different ways. Yes.
Well, let's see if we can see if I can ask a hard question. That we can. More ultimately in Laos in their own way, but sometimes amongst Vietnam volunteers, volunteers went out to Asia for a whole variety of reasons. Often including that reason was to know and make a contact with other cultures. They made that contact, and like you, it was an important one. It was the defining thing in their lives in terms of defining who they were and understanding what others were like, and making very specific friendships. And some IVSers married Vietnamese, others became very close to a lot of families. And then later, there was a sense of betrayal when they realized, and this was more for Laos folk, that they were essentially an adjunct of the USAID, or that they were actually, just by touting America or being Americans, a kind of sugarcoating to an American military operation which had a political goal of sustaining U.S. interests. And it wasn't they felt directly betrayed by IVS necessarily, you know, that there was some kind of conspiracy, that they eventually became uncomfortable or sad, or some it was disillusionment, massive disillusionment. For others it was more of, hey, well, this is the way the world is, you know, like that. And because you were isolated even from the USAID, let alone IBS, that question might not be that relevant to you. And also your experience was so intimate and so important. But did you ever feel that, ever have a reflection that somehow IBS was just too closely tied to the war?
I never did.
But that made the whole 5 minutes of questions seem pretty irrelevant, didn't it? Go ahead. Yeah.
It's interesting because in my whole 2 years there in Plaquemine, I don't think I ever spent many minutes at all ever talking politics with the Vietnamese. We discussed it sometimes. After my first year, I did share with my Vietnamese friends my situation with the draft and what was happening there. And it was an understandable situation to them because they or their friends were being drafted all the time. I think probably one of the best ways to explain it is this way. While I was in Pleiku, I and the people with whom I associated, we somehow felt that we were here in this time and place, and the war and the politics were over here. And it was almost, with the exception of the war, it was almost as we would never intertwine. It was a very carpe diem situation. We didn't worry about much. We were concerned about death, but we didn't let it dominate our lives. What dominated our lives were the immediate moment, the education of our students, and the time that we had to get in friendship or in understanding each other. It was almost like this war and these politics were in another world, kind of in another place. I did sign the letter that we wrote. I did sign that letter. And later on I wrote a letter of clarification to the President of the United States, clarifying my stance, telling him exactly why I had signed that letter, telling him that I signed it for these reasons. I could have not signed it for these reasons, but I signed it for these reasons. And I eventually got, in fact, I think the letter's in there, a letter from one of his assistants, Jordan, I think his name was, saying that, in fact, let me...